Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with six race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Title IX became law in 1972. As a result, any school that receives any federal money, so pretty much all schools, is required to provide fair and equal treatment of the sexes in all areas, including sports. Change didn't happen all at once, but during the 1970s, girls that had been forced to watch from the sidelines started to have real opportunities to join teams and compete. Melissa Isaacson was one of those girls. In 1975, she was a freshman at Niles West High School in suburban Chicago. She joined the brand new girls basketball team, and 4 years later, they won the state championship. She shares her story, the story of her team, and a story that will resonate with women everywhere in her new book, State. A team, a triumph, a transformation. Isaacson went on to an award-winning career as a sports writer and is now on faculty at Northwestern's Mendel School of Journalism. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Saturday, September 21st at 4 p.m. in conversation with the University of Iowa's Lisa Bluter. But she is with me on the line right now. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here.
I'm thrilled to be there, here, to be anywhere.
Right. Before we go way back in time to 1975, what was it that started you thinking about your high school basketball team again and made you start this journey?
Well, I think it never left me. You know, it's funny. I still consider it my claim to fame that I won a state championship, that I'm a state champ. You know, it's something that I think...
That's how you introduce yourself.
I know. It's on my calling card. It's like, you know, it's nobody who knows me doesn't know that. And so it's always been sort of inside of me, this wonderful story. I don't think I truly thought of telling it in a book form until 25 years later on the occasion of our 25th reunion, 25th anniversary of the state title, that a lot of things were happening at once. But I write about all in the prologue. My parents both had end-stage Alzheimer's. My father was in hospice, and it was the night that we were honored at halftime of the girls' basketball game. And that week I had written a column for the Chicago Tribune that was sort of met with, you know, sure, okay, write about your high school team 25 years later. I mean, they were nice about it, but I'm not sure anybody was all that thrilled. But it ended up being the skeleton for the story. It was so many things I learned as an adult that I never knew as a kid. All the heroes that we had around us, the coach, our first coach, Arlene Mulder, who I think is sort of the heroine of the book, who's a 30-year-old. No one wanted the job at the time. She was paid next to nothing. She had little experience. She played six-girl basketball, which your listeners, could relate to. She was in California, Northern California, but they, you know, of course, played six-girl basketball in many places, including Iowa. But she didn't know how to coach. And so what I found out was that she went to the legendary boys coach at the time at our school, and he secretly helped her in the corners of teacher's lounge and various little, you know, secret hiding places around the school. He would scribble on napkins, and he would literally teach her to teach us. And in the process, and it was incredibly unselfish of him at the time, if you can imagine, that they had to keep their relationship a secret, which is crazy, or they felt like they had. He didn't want to undermine her. Her ego was such that she didn't mind at all going to help, which was very unselfish of her. And and she taught him in the process all these wonderful leadership abilities and motivational skills that she had innately. She would become the five-term mayor of Arlington Heights, which is a suburb of Chicago and one of the it's the biggest village in the United States. She would become a very successful politician in later years. But as a young woman, she developed with us. She learned with us. And it was but one of many, many stories that came out of things that we had no idea. We didn't know about each other and all the things that, you know, were happening in our own homes. So that became the basis of the column, to wind back around to your question. And after the column, it became clear that it was it was sort of meant to be a book. And so, you know, with a little nudging, that's kind of where it started 15 years ago. And then it took 15 years for many reasons. I wrote another book in between that time. I completely reworked the book because it began as a young adult basketball book, which really wasn't doing it justice. And my parents passed away during that time, and it became very clear to me that there was just much more to the story. So it evolved, and then it took a while, as it often does, to find an interested publisher. And I think it was serendipitous that it happened when it did on the occasion this year of our 40th anniversary, in a time when clearly women's issues and women's sports are at the forefront. So I think it was meant to be in a lot of ways, and I'm really pleased with how it all sort of has come together, even though it took a long time.
Well, and when you mention it took a long time, reading the book, it becomes very clear why it took a long time. You didn't just share your memories about your high school basketball team. I mean, you came at this as a journalist. You reported this story. You talked to everybody who was involved, and you dug up records that I guess I'm surprised they even kept.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, the good thing is there's two good things. One, when I started 15 years ago, I joked that our memories were a lot better. So we were able to, you know, all the stories we'd been telling for the first 25 years after school were still very fresh in our minds. But more than that, back to, you know, the records. I mean, in those days, people kept scrapbooks. You know, everybody, girls had diaries and scrapbooks, and there was just a wealth of a treasure trove of that. And then there was also local media covered us like crazy. I mean, it almost makes me sad now to see how they covered, you know, women's sports and girls' sports back in the day. And obviously, it was a factor of many things, one of which newspapers had space to devote to that. But the Chicago Tribune had full pages of coverage on us. We had the CBS affiliate, in particular in Chicago, spent a lot of time with us. The suburban papers, of course, were all over us. So there was a lot of that. And we had game tapes and 16-millimeter and 8-millimeter and really fun. And then the state tournament was on WGN. So while those big, giant reels of tape surprisingly don't exist, they had to throw them away because they literally couldn't store them anymore. Luckily, we had a wonderful audiovisual man at the school who was also our Spanish teacher who had the wherewithal to tape. In those days, it was, you know, Betamaxes were far and few between, and he taped, you know, our games on WGN, thank God, and we converted them to DVD, and I am so grateful that we have that.
Yeah, that's really incredible to have that record. And you mentioned the scrapbooks. You actually collected the scrapbooks of all of your teammates so you could go through them and glean what you could?
Collected is a nice word. I said I held them hostage, and every so often I would every few years I would write big apology emails to all my teammates saying, I swear this isn't an imaginary book. It really is happening, and I'm not going to hold your scrapbooks hostage forever, because they were so precious. If, you know, if you can imagine, too, 30, 40 years later, if you even opened a page, all the, you know, scotch tape would just disintegrate, you know, and just kind of into dust in my hands. So I was really cognizant of how, and it was a big deal for them to sort of, I mean, of course, they were very generous, but to hand over all of that for years, I tried giving it back a few times. They were like, no, no, just, you know, keep it. So I had stacks and stacks. Everyone had scrapbooks. It was really cool.
Well, we need to take a break in just a moment. But before we do that, let's go back to 1975 and introduce us to Melissa Isaacson in 1975.
Wow. Awkward, I would say. About 95 pounds, maybe. 5'1", maybe. I thought I was 5'2". With short hair that I had my whole life, and I look like a boy. And, you know, older people, if you had short hair, you were a boy. And if you had longer hair over your ears, you were a girl. You know, and that was that. So I was often mistaken for a boy. I only wanted so badly to fit in, but mostly that meant playing sports. I was outgoing. I don't want to act like I never spoke. I mean, I was very outgoing in sports. I was really confident in sports.
But I really wanted to be on a real team.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking to Melissa Isaacson. Her book is State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Saturday, September 21st at 4 p.m. in conversation with the University of Iowa's women's basketball coach, Lisa Bluder. And we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Deadline for late summer registration is September 22nd. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me now is Melissa Isaacson. She's an award-winning sports journalist. Right now, she is on faculty at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. She's also a University of Iowa graduate. She has just published a book called State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. It's about her high school basketball team and their journey to the state tournament in Illinois. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Saturday, September 21st. At 4 p.m. in conversation with the University of Iowa women's basketball coach Lisa Bluder. And Melissa, just before the break, we'd gone back in time to 1975 and met tomboy Melissa looking for her place in the world, a freshman in high school, looking for that team that you could belong on. And so as you were finding your place, you've also, like I said, you did a great deal of reporting about this. You've also reported about what was going on behind the scenes at your school as the girls' basketball team was being formed. That was something a lot of people didn't want to happen, right?
Well, yes, absolutely. One thing I didn't realize, you know, as I grew up and a lot of kids in Illinois, we would watch the state tournament. And our principal, Nicholas Manis, was one of the guys in the Blazers on the IHSA board who would hand out the medals and the trophy. And we always thought, well, I didn't think one day it would be me because it couldn't be. You know, at that time, it was always the boys that were getting them. But in later years, and, you know, as I did the reporting, I realized that he, not only did he do that, but he was really paramount in the fight to get us a state championship and to get us even varsity sports at all for girls. So every year he would go downstate and sort of fight with, he called them the crew cuts, because they were, you know, the men that didn't want girls anywhere near the gym, didn't want us taking up valuable gym space on Friday nights, especially during their basketball games, and certainly didn't want us, you know, to play sports that they deemed dangerous. So he would every year kind of plot his strategy. You know, he'd try for sports that were less what they would consider dangerous, like badminton and tennis and then volleyball. And eventually he worked his way to basketball, but it was frustrating. And I found out about those meetings. And, you know, that was also really illuminating to me to see kind of what happened. Because when he did give us the trophy in 1979, we thought, aren't we so lucky that we gave our principal this wonderful gift that he could give his own team the state championship trophy? And I wrote a column in later when he passed away in obit that wound up on the front page of the Chicago Tribune. And the last line was, we never knew, you know, he gave it to us. You know, he was the one who did it all for us. He was the best friend we never knew we had.
When you were finding your way to that basketball team, you were also really at the forefront of a movement into women's athletics. And one of the things you write about is going to the store to buy your basketball shoes. And there were no such thing as girls' basketball shoes back then. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a lot of things. Yeah, like, you know, I have a whole part about, you know, sports bras.
Right.
You know, that was a foreign concept. I mean, there was no such thing as that. But, yeah, the shoes, you know, you'd go to the store and, first of all, girls didn't buy boys' shoes. I mean, when at least I didn't. When we were little, you know, you had deck shoes or these little pointy PF Flyers. I don't know if anybody in your audience remembers those. But I wanted the shoes like the boys had, and I certainly, we all wanted Converse. Those were the shoes to have. And so they were wide, and I had narrow girls' feet. And so I had to wear extra socks to even keep them on, and, you know, boys' shorts, and my mom would look suspiciously at me like, those shorts are too wide, the shoes are too big, the socks are too long. You know, everything was sort of not quite right, but I was thrilled. I mean, it was beyond thrilling to finally have a real uniform and represent our school. That was completely foreign to us.
Absolutely. As you mentioned earlier, the coach of your girls' team, who was at the forefront of really fighting for this opportunity for you and for the other girls on your team. But Arlene Mulder, as you said, she'd played 6-on-6 basketball, so 5-on-5 basketball was new to her. But she also had never coached basketball. So this whole right. thing was brand new to her. She was a teacher with two young girls at home. And you wrote so much about her in the book, and she really came to life for me on those pages. But after going back and talking with her, why was it so important to her to coach this team? Because she gave it her all.
Yeah, she really did. She battled with it, you know, just the age-old sort of women's guilt of not giving enough to your kids, although in the 70s with women getting more opportunities to work and coach, the guilt maybe was that much, I don't know, you know, more stronger, if you will. So she had that pull at home. She always felt like she wasn't giving enough time to her kids. But she, you know, it took her a long time to admit it. It took her years and years to say, you know what, I really, really loved it. I mean, she knew she loved it back then, but she was afraid to actually admit it. It had to be, well, you know, I make a little more money, and it's important, and they need me, and the girls need me, and they asked me to coach. But she thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, and I think she felt a little guilty about that. She learned, like I said, right along with us. And she had all these talents that she didn't know she had. She looks back now, and I mean, 5 terms as the mayor, she can't walk down the street in Arlington Heights without being mobbed to this day, and she's been retired for some time. U.S. presidents know her. Governors, you know, of Illinois are well acquainted with her. And she, you know, all of those things that she learned and that she developed were all through leading us. We're all through coaching us, and she still says after all of that very prestigious career that was the most rewarding period of her professional life.
In so many ways, I feel like she was a visionary coach, because while she was getting advice from a very supportive coworker, she also had a very strong feeling of what it meant for you guys to be part of a team. And mm-hmm. she stuck with that even when maybe other coaches would have thought that what she was doing didn't make sense. Can you tell me a little bit about the team ethic that she tried to instill in you and how she carried that out?
Yeah, I mean, she absolutely demanded unselfishness on our part. And of course, we were just sponges. We didn't know any differently. But we did not know how many points we scored. She used everybody on her bench. She insisted that we play and that we take on this incredible team attitude that carried with us even after she left and really won us the state championship as much as anything. She was doing things that nobody was doing at the time, and I don't think, you know, certainly we didn't recognize positive imagery, you know, laying on our backs in a dark little self-balcony gym that we had that was a dance studio, really. We weren't allowed in the quote-unquote boys' gym. You know, we were allowed, but we weren't allowed to practice or play. That's what they called it when we first got into school. And we'd lay on our backs with the lights off, and she'd have us envision, you know, making our shots and squaring up for rebounds and, you know, following through and all this cool stuff that really, you know, coaches would do and sports psychologists would do. She gave us books, The Prophet, and wrote inscriptions in it. And I covered the Bulls later years. Phil Jackson gave his players books. I laughed, you know, later, oh, Mrs. Mulder did this, you know. Plyometrics and you know, all kinds of stuff that she kind of discovered and learned about and did. But that unselfishness was one thing that she absolutely, you know, insisted upon. And I think it, again, you know, I look at the teams I covered, and I look at the Bulls, for instance, and I covered the Bulls during their glory years. And Michael Jordan was a wonderful player for years, and they didn't win championships. And it was really only when he bought into much more of a team concept under Phil Jackson and Tex Winter and the triangle offense that was predicated on every player touching the ball. Phil, Michael Jordan passed the ball to John Paxson for the last shot, you know, one of their championships, and another to Steve Kerr. The old Michael Jordan may not have done that, but so, you know, basketball is meant to be a team sport, and she knew that, and she, there was just no stars on our team, and it was a wonderful thing. It was a wonderful life lesson as much as anything else.
You write about every single one of the girls that was on that varsity squad with you, and you obviously spent a lot of time talking with them about what was going on in their lives during that time. A lot of things that you wouldn't have known about as their friend and their teammate. Why is it important, do you feel, for us to learn those stories, to understand all of the complicated things that these girls were experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, I think it just, you know, is the underlying theme is that basketball saved us and did things for us that it had been done for boys, team sports, for years and years. In the 70s, you know, if a neighbor was getting divorced or you know, had a serious illness, you know, your parents might know, but they'd whisper it. You know, you weren't supposed to know what was going on in other people's homes. It was none of our business. And certainly there was no social media to broadcast things like that. And so there were all kinds of incredible things going on in our homes that none of us knew, but our best friends. We had things that the odds showed that were happening in homes across America, alcoholism and mental health issues and serious illness, and you just didn't know. And so my teammates were incredibly, incredibly generous in sharing those stories as adults, and I think it just showed you know, what we were dealing with and what basketball did to deliver us from some of that pain and some of that loneliness and give us a place where we could express ourselves in a way, again, that boys have been doing for so long and just get access to the life lessons and to the teamwork and support that boys had always kind of been part of Little League and everything else. So, you know, one of my teammates, I learned years later that she wasn't supposed to go to our school. She was in a different district. And I always thought, well, wow, you know, what happened? I mean, she could have gotten us disqualified, and she happened to be one that bumped me out of the regular rotation, and so I was always a little resentful. And so in the prologue, I kind of confront her 25 years later and say, what was the deal? First, I asked her, was I mean to you? Because I was afraid that my resentment showed, and she said, oh, gosh, no, you know, don't you remember how much I looked up to you, and we laughed, and I loved you. She was a freshman when I was a senior, and we won. And she ends up telling me, you know, leaning across the table and saying, you know, Missy, you didn't know? And I said, no. What are you talking about? When I asked her about why she went to our school, she said, Miss, basketball saved me. And I still get chills when I tell that story, and it became sort of the mantra for the book. I would find out that basketball saved us all, and you come to learn about Becky in the book and how basketball saved her and why she ended up at our school. And it was, I won't tell the whole story and ruin it, but her father, who was a physical education teacher in the district, I figured, oh, he must have pulled strings. Well, yeah, he pulled strings. He went to the school board and begged for his daughter to come to our school because we had a basketball program, and the other school that she was supposed to go to didn't. And so it was a wonderful thing.
I think Melissa just, oh, there you are. Your line cut out for just a moment. So it was such a powerful thing for Becky, but also for the other girls on the team. And before we get to the next break, you had this wonderful coach who was willing to give you so much of her time and energy. But for you and for a couple of your other teammates, that was not enough. And so you guys went above and beyond, and you created your own practice schedule. Tell me about your before school practices. Well, Melissa will tell us about the before school practices when she gets back in a few minutes. But you know what we'll do right now? Let's talk about fundraising. By the way, I'm talking to Melissa Isaacson, author of State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. And we'll be back with her in just a few minutes. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest is Melissa Isaacson. She's the author of State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. It is about her high school basketball team, Niles West High School in suburban Chicago, and their journey to winning the state championship when she was a senior in high school. She is an award-winning sports writer. She's now on faculty at Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. A while back, she also graduated with her undergraduate degree from the University of Iowa, and she'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Saturday, September 21st at 4 p.m. in conversation with the University of Iowa's women's basketball coach, Lisa Bluder. And Melissa, you had this wonderful coach, Mrs. Mulder, who gave you so much of her time, so much of her energy. But for you and a couple of your friends on the team, that was not enough. You guys were so incredibly driven and you just wanted more, more, more. So tell me about your morning practices and how those came about.
Right. Well, it was such a thrill to just be, you know, allowed in the gym. As I said, when we entered school, it was considered the quote-unquote boys' gym, the big contest gym, and we weren't able to practice or play. So anytime we got in any gym inside was really thrilling. When we learned that we couldn't, you know, didn't have any time for us after school, we asked about before school. Well, 6 o'clock, the men's teachers played. Okay, how about 5 o'clock? Well, yeah, you could, as long as you're off the court by six. So we'd leave at 4:30. My friend Shirley would, you know, drive up the street in her Gremlin with no muffler and pick me up, and we'd pick up others. And, you know, somehow we all made it to school. All of us would show up every time. And those scrimmages that we played at 4:35 in the morning were among the most thrilling that, you know, we ever played, because just the freedom and the ability to just play in the big gym, in the boys' gym, and be able to play for an hour and a half and really experience the joy of the game. And pretty soon we picked up some boys who scrimmaged against us. And again, this was somewhat unheard of. And our coach, tried to keep it from her because she wouldn't want us to get hurt. She would be afraid that, you know, somehow our parents would find out and, you know, kill her because, you know, what is she doing allowing us to play with boys elbowing us in the head? And they did. You know, we wanted them to play hard. So every day, you know, almost one of us would go down with a bloody nose or a concussion or, you know, a lump on our heads. And we would barely hit the ground when the rest of us would, you know, scream, "Get up, you're fine, get up," because we didn't want the rest of the teachers to find out and to, you know, stop us from playing. So, you know, when we were little, we hung around with the boys, we tagged around, but this was different. This was real competition. We played against them, and it was thrilling. And I remember the first time we beat them. These were guys that were not varsity athletes, but that they were good athletes. They were maybe on other teams, and they played hard. And the day that we beat them was really special. I still remember it.
That junior year turned out to be the last year that Mrs. Mulder coached you. Sure. And that was because she was pregnant with her third child, something that she kept a secret for most of that last year. So mm-hmm. As an adult, 25, 30, now 40 years later, going back and exploring what that was like for her must have been so interesting to see it from a completely different perspective. But tell me a little bit about what she was experiencing that year as she was keeping her pregnancy a secret and trying to coach you guys to a state championship. You didn't quite make it that year, but you were awfully close.
Right. I mean, we were oblivious as kids because, you know, when you're 16, 17 years old, all your thoughts are mostly about yourself and what you're doing. So while we loved her, we just thought, well, you know, her taste in clothes is slipping a little because she'd be wearing baggy clothes, you know. It didn't occur to us. She was sort of heartbroken. You know, she was thrilled that it was a surprise pregnancy. I mean, she admits it, but she had two older girls, not older, 6 and 8, I believe, and wasn't really expecting, but thrilled with the news, but also struggling with how she was going to tell us. So she waited a long time. And of course, you know, I kind of joke now that, of course, she got pregnant and had to leave. You know, she couldn't have, like, had the baby gone on a short leave and then come back to coach us. It was like, no, she has to go away. She's pregnant. And so she had, you know, she was pregnant. We all joked that, well, you're going to name him, if it's a boy, Wesley, right, after Niles West. And, you know, she laughed and nodded. And it was, yeah, it was very, very emotional when she said goodbye. It was as if she was sort of betraying us in a way. And we never saw that baby. And that she had a boy, and she named him Michael. She didn't name him Wesley, surprise, surprise, because it's such a great name. A few months ago, I went to her house, and I've talked to her many times over the years, but this time I went to her house, and she had found some film for me that she wanted me to see. And a guy answers the door. He's this big, tall, good-looking guy, and I walk in, and he gives me this huge hug, and he whispers in my ear, "I'm Michael." I could almost cry telling this story right now. It was really emotional, and he says, "Thank you for telling me my mother's story, things I never knew about her." And he said it much more eloquently than I am. But, and I just looked at him, and I'm like, "I bet you're 40 years old now, right?" And, of course, he is. And it was so emotional for me. I had never met him. I knew he existed, obviously. But to see him standing there in real life and thanking me for giving me a piece of his mother's history that he never knew was really, really special. And he was the reason she left us, and yet, you know, he was obviously a gift to them, and, you know, it was just a lot of emotions in now, 40 years later, and some of the things I'm finding out even now.
Well, and that was a really painful separation for her, too. As much joy as she had in becoming a mother again, she didn't feel like she could come to your games. She didn't feel like she could reach out. And again, you were a bunch of teenagers. You guys weren't reaching out to her either.
No, you know, you didn't call a teacher at home. And we felt like she deserted us. But in reality, she wanted to come, but she didn't want to get in the way of the new coach. We got the guy who was this freshman and sophomore boys coach, the driver's ed teacher at the school. And he was very colorful and charismatic. And
very reluctant to become your coach.
He didn't want to be our coach and wanted to watch his son play basketball and really, frankly, didn't have any desire to coach girls. And so, you know, she didn't want to get in his way. She thought that we needed to bond with him. He, frankly, did not ask her to come to games. So she stayed away. She thought that was best, even though it broke her heart. And it made us... We were a little mad at her. I personally felt like she sort of left us and deserted us. And so, in a way, she was right. It made us bond a little bit more with the new guy, which, you know, we had to do in order to win. And she got us right to the precipice. We went to Super Sectionals, they call them in Illinois, which is the game before, it's the final 16, the game before, you know, you get downstate with the Elite Eight. And we made it to Super Sectionals for 2 years with her and lost really heartbreaking games. And then she left, and then the men's coach came. And so we were, you know, and he admits it now, she had delivered to him a team that was just ready to win a state championship. And he did a great job, but he really was sort of the caretaker, you know, and sort of delivered, you know, the state championship as we all expected. There was a lot of pressure on him. And like I said, like you said, he didn't want the job, but he eventually fell in love with it and with us, and we did with him as well. But it was a different experience playing for a man, for sure.
When you won that state tournament, and you do share all the details of what went into that and what went on, how did that change your idea of who you were? And you know, I know you've talked to all the women on the team, and it was so significant for all of them. But to you, how do you think that changed your idea of who you were?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorite parts of the book is the epilogue, because it says kind of what happened to us. And I have no doubt in my mind that the confidence that playing for that team gave to me, this idea that anything was possible if you worked hard enough, gave me a work ethic and gave me this incredible optimism about achieving whatever you set your mind on, and about teamwork and working together, that would serve me absolutely, you know, well, and made me who I was. You know, I told Birch Bayh, who was, of course, the co-author of Title IX, a senator, I spoke to him a few years ago, and he And I said to him, you made me who I was. You made me, you know, responsible for what I did for a living, for the man I married, for the way we raised our children, the fact that I walked into the Daily Iowan with this one little story on Ronnie Lester grasped in my two little fists, you know, to hand over to the sports editor, Heidi McNeil, at the time. And to even have that courage to do that, I don't know that I would have done that. I don't know that I would have chosen journalism and sports writing, which was obviously a man's world even more then than now. I don't think I would have had the courage to do that if it hadn't been for my experience in high school. So I owe everything to Title IX and to Birch Bayh and to Arlene Mulder and to Gene Earle and to the experience we had in high school. And it just shows how important, not just sports, because my kids didn't play sports, but they had, you know, team activities. They had the freedom to play whatever they wanted. They played sports as little kids. And then in high school, my son played soccer. My daughter went on to other things, to theater and to speech and journalism and all kinds of stuff that they were great at. But they had the ability and the freedom to do that. And they learned all those really cool lessons in youth sports as kids. And, you know, the first time my daughter came in with this cool soccer uniform, you know, when she was 5 years old, it just made me flash back to how that thrill of wearing our first really icky uniforms, you know, that we had.
Terrible polyester.
Terrible, yeah. Just thick polyester. You know, our school name wasn't on them. And I wrote that it may as well have been the U.S. Olympic, you know, uniform. It may as well have said USA across my chest. That's how proud and how just giving a kid a uniform, how much that meant to me. So it absolutely shaped who I became, for sure.
So many years later, the young women who are playing sports at high schools everywhere now, most of them, thankfully, take it for granted that they have these opportunities. But what do you want them to know? What do you think they could learn from this story?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, nobody when you're a teenager wants, you know, older people to tell you, you don't appreciate where you came from and, you know, you should learn history and that sort of thing. It's, you know, I think that we did know about the girls that came before us and played basketball. I think we did appreciate it. I wouldn't try to kind of shove that down the throats of kids now. But I would say for a minute, you know, if you can read my book, you know, read my book and do think about where you came from. Do think about the people that made it possible for you to have a uniform and to play on a court inside, on a real court, and with, you know, the boys having equal time. You know, as a boy, there's plenty of lessons and plenty of stories in the book that I think will resonate with men and boys as well. But it doesn't hurt any of us to sort of take a look around and say, you know, who are our heroes? Who made it possible for me to do this? And it doesn't have to be someone 40 years earlier. I mean, it could be your history teacher. It could be your basketball coach or your Cub Scout leader, whoever it is. We all have really important people in our life. And as kids, we seldom realize it. We seldom stop and thank them for what they did for us. And I think it's really important to at least kind of take a second and think about that. And, yeah, I mean, you know, I talk to kids all the time, and I tell them, write a thank you note.
Yeah,
you know,
Melissa,
write a handwritten thank you note.
We are out of time, but thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Melissa Isaacson, she is the author of State, A Team, A Triumph, A Transformation. She'll be at Prairie Lights Bookstore in Iowa City on Saturday, September 21st, in conversation with the University of Iowa women's basketball coach, Lisa Bluder. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.